Today on Maine Calling, artist David Driscoll's impact on Maine and the art world. When David Driscoll died in 2020, we lost one of the most influential American artists of his time. Driscoll created bold and distinctive art with works in many major museum collections. He was also a teacher, collector, and champion of other Black artists. People who knew him describe him as a wonderful man. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we learn about David Driscoll. Born in rural Georgia, he spent his most influential years dividing his time between Maine and Maryland. Two current exhibits in Portland pay tribute to Driscoll. And this week, Maine Public Television airs a film about his life. The Life and Art of David Driscoll. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And Highland Green, an active 55-plus lifestyle community with a 230-acre nature preserve, highlandgreenlifestyle.com. And Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com.
This is Maine Calling, and I'm Jennifer Rooks. David Driscoll was a great artist and so much more. He connected people, curated others' work, and he raised the profiles of African-American artists for posterity. Today, we're going to learn about this important figure in the art world who lived and worked in Maine. Joining me, Jordia Benjamin, who is Executive Director of the Indigo Arts Alliance, Anjali Leibowitz, curator of photography at the Portland Museum of Art, and we're going to hear from many others as well. We invite you to join the conversation. Are you a fan of David Driscoll's art? Did you know him? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both so much for joining us today, and I'll start with you, Jordia. For those who are not familiar with Driscoll's art, describe it for us. It's kind of hard to categorize, right?
It really is. You are starting off strong. How do you even talk about Driscoll's work and name it? It is very... He is known as a painter, but also has experimented and have work in printmaking as well. His work is layered. It is collaged in some manner. And it also tells, it has a strong underlining of storytelling of where we are in a particular period, what's going on in the country, what he's looking at, his placement, his where he is in space and time. So it's completely range, and it is very colorful in some places, in some pieces very vibrant, in others it has a very more darker tones. It just depends on what story he is conveying at that particular moment in time. So I hope that gives a little bit of an introduction, but I encourage folks as we talk to visit if they are seated to just look at Driscoll's imageries as we talk. So it'll add a little bit more context to what we're speaking about today.
Yeah, and you're a great sport because asking you to describe his work on the radio is really challenging. I know, and I mean, you know, you, as soon as you say it's really vibrant and colorful, I think about this sort of black and white and gray work that I'm familiar with, and you know, so it usually is, but not always. And but the thing is, Jordia, you know it when you see it, right? Even despite definitely. All the variety, you know it when you see it.
You really do. He has a signature hand. That you are able to identify his work immediately when you see it, which is speaks to the legacy that he's left behind and also his skillmanship as a trained artist.
Anjali, one of the reasons we're talking about David Driscoll today is that we claim him as a Mainer. He was not born in Maine. Tell us about his life path. How did he come to work, you know, part of the year, every year in Maine?
Oh, wow. Another big question. And Jordia, you did such a fantastic job of describing his art to people who can't see it. So he's born in Eaton in Georgia. He moves when he's quite young to North Carolina, attends segregated schools, and he tells a great story about ending up at Howard University. He just brings his transcript. He shows up 3 weeks after classes end, and he says, you know, I want to be enrolled. And he said, well, maybe you should, you know, have an application. Maybe you should consider waiting. He said, no, I'm here. Let's do it. So he enrolls as a history major. He starts on that path. And in 1951, he enrolls in his first drawing class. And he is spotted immediately, almost immediately in this class, by no other than James Porter, who is an incredibly important figure in art history and at Howard University. And the faculty are taken with David and his talent, and they vote unanimously for him to have a scholarship to Skowhegan, which he balks at a little bit. He says, you know, Maine's far. I have a family, you know, maybe I shouldn't be away for the summer. And the faculty says, you're going. So he acquiesces, he goes. One of his other mentors, Lois Malyu Jones, suggests a nice place for him to stay in Boston. He takes the train up. And he ends up at Skowhegan, and it changes his entire life. It creates a lifelong relationship with Maine, its landscape, and its artistic networks.
And we're going to hear from folks at the Skowhegan School later. I understand, Jordia, that he fell in love with pine trees. Maine pines, because there are pines in Georgia and North Carolina, but the white pine.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. I think when Driscoll came and actually made Maine his summer home in Falmouth, his studio and his home is situated amongst nature. And so when you look out, there are just endless amount of trees, and that has showed up in a lot of his work. So the Maine pine tree is also a very staple in his practice, and it also dictates, you know, the season, time of day that he's painting, and then also this overly textured painting application he's also using. So you could almost sense the needles that are coming off of the trees, and almost it captures the scent as well of where you are in a particular season, and you are seated in viewing his interpretation of Maine's landscape, which is just truly settling, and it provides another layer of like peace and calm of like, how do you really capture something that is overly common in our state in a way that is still alluring and captivating?
Anjali, the Portland Museum of Art right now has a show of Driscoll's, but it's not his work, it's his collection. And I want to talk about that in just a minute. But a few years ago, right after David Driscoll died of COVID in 2020, which is, I mean, what a loss. But there was a major retrospective of his work at the Portland Museum of Art. And I understand he helped with that. And it was called Icons of Nature and History. We're talking about nature and the influence of the white pine. But tell us about the connection of nature and history, why the retrospective was titled that in 2021, and how you think about that.
Oh, this is a wonderful question. I'm not quite sure I'm the right person. I arrived in the end of 2021, and that exhibition was organized by my predecessors. But it was such a beautiful, I had the chance to see it. It was an absolutely gorgeous exhibition. And so while I can't speak to exactly why it was named Icons of Nature and History, I can say that it's the perfect title for his incredible work. The way that Jordia describes his treatment of something like pine trees, of thinking about nature as iconic, as symbolic, as deeply meaningful to you both as an individual and within the cultural environment that you're living in. I think about one of his historical precedents that he really brought to the fore, Edward Mitchell Bannister, a New England Black painter who paints the New England landscape, and thinking about moving through it as a Black person in New England, whether historically or contemporarily, I think is something that David so beautifully conveys in his pictures, and also his deep personal relationship to the landscape. So he's able to both bring in the universal and the personal that is just really, really powerful. And that exhibition was so special because it was organized with him, and it was in Portland, and it was also at the High Museum, right? So he has so many connections, so many different places in his home state in Washington, D.C. Here, there's just so many ways in which he fully influenced the entire art historical field, both as an artist, scholar, and a curator.
In the High Museum, of course, in Atlanta, Georgia, and it is named. And not only do they have many of his works in their collection, but an important art prize to a young African American artist is something that is put out by the High Museum in Atlanta. Jordi, we were talking about how David Driskell is a collector, and this is the basis of the show currently at the Portland Museum of Art. I read that he began collecting when he was a very young man and had a very frugal lifestyle. He still set aside something like $3,000 a year to collect art and to collect black art. And today, people might, oh, I don't know, people might cringe a little bit and think, I don't like being called a black artist, or I don't want to be called a woman artist, or I don't want to be categorized. But take us back to the 1960s and the 1970s, when Driskell was spending his hard-earned money on creating this collection.
Yeah, I think Aunt Julie is going to have to help me on
Okay.
his beginning collection. But what I could state is Driskell is evidence that anyone and everyone can be contributing and supporting artists. I think as an artist himself, he realized the importance of ensuring that his colleagues were also had an additional stream of income, right? Artists are living off of their art. And so to be an artist and to support our other artists in that aspect, again, speaks to this network that is so important to the stability of the arts as a sector in itself. And so even something that's very small, and there's also opportunities for artists to trade among themselves as well. So they would contribute a work in lieu of receiving another work. So I think no matter where we are financially, we have that responsibility to ensure that the artists that are in our community, in our networks, are supported through the means of collection. And then I also want to mention that there was a recent article that came out. I can't remember or place it, but it spoke about how collectors are the true movers of the art field. Collectors are the ones that state who is going to be the leading artist, and not necessarily who you would think to for museums or for galleries. It's really the collectors who are on the ground and acquiring works and pieces that continues to elevate and also sustain their lifestyle as creatives. So I'll ping it back over of like
Yeah, and I'll
what
turn to
he
Anjali
actually
about
collected.
talking about his life as a collector. And it occurs to me, Anjali, that 2026, this year, right now, when the show is on at the Portland Museum of Art, is the 50th anniversary of a very important show that he curated called Two Centuries of Black American Art, which opened in 1976 at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. So I would love it if you could tell us a little bit about that show, the significance of it, and the significance that it was 50 years ago.
Oh, well, that's a lot. So Two Centuries of Black Art at LACMA is just one of those groundbreaking moments in the art historical field. And it really establishes the field, so it solidifies the field of African American art history. He had been working on it while he was at the Talladega University. He's teaching there in the 1970s. And he previously had been at Fisk University, which had received a very large gift from Georgia O'Keeffe. And he stewarded that collection of American art. And of course, he noticed this huge gap of missing people. And he really was combating, I think, two things. One, that Black art couldn't be in museums, but also that there had been no Black artists. And he was really saying there were historical precedents, I will name them, I will find them, and I will show them to you. And you know, the show is actually criticized a little bit for being a little too unwieldy. It didn't have some sort of through line or theme that critics could identify. And he said that was the point. I am establishing an area of expertise and an area of scholarship, and you guys have to go out and find the details, and you find the through lines, and we'll do the shows. And it really does kick off. You know, I think Jordia and I are both products of the world that he birthed for us, to have Black art in museums, to have Black curators in museums, or in wonderful independent organizations as well. Just it's hard to overstate how important that exhibition was, to the field. And I think it did grow out in many ways from him being part of these artistic communities and collecting himself. So he's collecting his friends like Alma Thomas and Elizabeth Catlett, and also seeking out these historical precedents like Bannister, Fuller, you know, thinking about who preceded us and where did we come from.
And Anjali, we can see that variety in the show right now at the Portland Museum of Art, correct?
Yes. So the show is really about the conversation between him as collector and artist. So you'll see really wonderful pairings between Alma Thomas and work of his of Frosty Night in Maine, using that sort of staccato technique that she's so known for. He almost adopts that in a way, to sort of show like the frost on a window. You also see his influence of Romare Bearden, who was a great friend of his. He even made a work called Homage to Romare, and Romare said, "Hey, maybe don't use my style." And that, and David talks about this, you know, that really spurred him to think about collage as his own and coming up with this way of painting abstract images on canvas and then stripping them and interleaving them with paper. There's a really beautiful work in the show called Procession 3, which I recommend everyone go see. You know, and also his pine trees are put in conversation with Bannister, who I've mentioned a few times, this 19th century painter. And so there's just this wonderful way in which he's both collecting and learning, going into artist studios, being in conversation both in person, but also going back to his own studio and making in conversation that is really brought out quite well in this exhibition.
On the line now is Kelly Lear, who is co-owner and co-director at Cove Street Arts in Portland. Thanks so much for calling in, Kelly.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we've talked to Anjali about the exhibit at the Portland Museum of Art, which is highlighting David Driscoll's collection, but you are exhibiting some of Driscoll's art right now, correct? Tell us about your show.
We're exhibiting some of David's artwork. He's on our roster, so we always have his work in inventory, but in conjunction with the PMA's show, our exhibition has David's artwork and then also some pieces from David and Thelma's collection that are for sale. And it's a good opportunity for us to announce that we do have access to works from the collection. And having the works by Jacob Lawrence and Aaron Douglas and Sam Gilliam on display with David's own work really draws out who he was as a collector and curator in addition to his studio practice. Because, as I'm sure was already pointed out, he knew all of the giants in African American art personally. And he began collecting early on. And just some fun little tie-ins. It's a big tapestry, really. And you can't understate the influence that he had on the canon. And he did begin collecting very early on. So in our show, we have a beautiful print by Sam Gilliam. And Alma Thomas, who was one of the first artists that David purchased a piece of art for, I believe for Fisk, don't quote me on that, was a big influence on Sam Gilliam. And Aaron Douglas is the person who wooed David to the Fisk faculty for the amount of time that he taught there.
Kelly,
And
I just
Aaron.
yeah, I was hoping that you could reflect on what you hope people will understand about the significance of David Driscoll.
What I hope people will understand is that he was an absolute giant as an artist, a curator, and an intellectual, and he had such a strong tie to Maine. He went to Skowhegan in 53 and fell in love with it. Part of it was the pine trees reminded him of his childhood home in North Carolina, and he was very, very tied to nature and the earth. And so in, I believe it was 63, he bought a piece of land in Falmouth, and he built his own studio, and he returned there every summer to paint until the year before he died. So he had deep, deep roots in Maine, and he incorporated the Maine scenery. He would do the Maine scenery, but also include a lot of his other iconic symbolism with the masks and the Hunt's chapels from the South that his father was a minister in, and things like that. I'd really like for people to understand how lucky we were to have him working here for all these years, and how important he was as an artist and a curator and an intellectual.
Kelly, thanks so much for calling in. Kelly Lear with Cove Street Arts. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Welcome back. Today, we are talking about the work of artist David Driskell, why he was so consequential, and what he was like. My guests are Anjali Leibowitz, who is curator of photography at the Portland Museum of Art, and Jordia Benjamin, executive director of Indigo Arts Alliance. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you know about David Driskell? Were you lucky enough to know him? Do you have some of his artwork? Did you ever meet him or get a chance to visit him in the studio? We'd love to hear from you. Send us a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now is Katie Sonnenborn. She is co-director at the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture. Thanks so much for calling in, Katie.
Happily. How are you?
Great. Well, we've heard that David Driskell attended Skowhegan in 1953 and that it was life-changing for him. How did he stay connected to the school, and how did he influence others later on?
So David, as you said, came to Skowhegan in 53. At the time, we had a standing relationship with Howard University, and one of his mentors there, James Porter, and Lois Miller Jones, who was a friend of our founder, Bill Cummings, put David forward, and he got a scholarship, and that was the first introduction to Skowhegan and to Maine that he had. And he ended up coming back really for the rest of his life. He was a faculty artist 5 or 6 times in the 70s, in the 90s, and in the early 2000s. He served on our Board of Governors, which is the artist board that oversees the school and the pedagogy. He was on that board for about 15 years. Then he flipped and he served as a trustee for another almost 15 years. And he was on an advisory committee until the time of his death in 2020. So I think with Skowhegan, David was really, he was a lifetime sort of connective tissue between the generations of artists who were there. He was in Falmouth, of course, in the summer, and he used to come over annually to hear lectures and to visit with younger artists. So I think what was important for us as an organization and for the artists who passed through was that kind of each decade, right, he had an influence and a dialogue with students. And that was really kind of a defining quality that he brought to the campus, this sort of curiosity and interest always in what the next generation was doing, what they were thinking about, how they were making. And his presence there was really, really palpable. He just had kind of an aura and energy around him when he would come and visit. It was incredibly magnetic.
Oh, Katie, thank you so much for calling in and joining us. Katie Sonnenborn is with the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture. We're going to turn now to Peggy Golden, who is the founder of Green Hut Galleries. Peggy, I understand you not only sold David's work, but you also knew him personally. What was he like?
He was an absolutely wonderful human being, and I learned so much from David, but this is an example of David the man. If you had dinner at his house, he would plate up a beautiful plate, beautifully arranged with all kinds of produce and fruit from his garden. And he would gather you around the table, you would hold hands, and he would say grace. And at the end of grace, he would say, "Amen, a woman." And I just love that.
He
a wonderful gardener. He built his own studio. He recycled everything to the point that his master printmaker would yell at him because he was ruining the press by doing his work on found pieces of wood that he found in the yard. And they had a little banter going on about that. And if you all watch the film on Maine Public, you will see a little bit of that dynamic. But Scout Hegan was so central in David's life. When he came in 1953, he was one of probably very few men in Maine who were black. Years later, in 1961, he came to Maine to look at the property that he ultimately ended up buying in Falmouth. But he had to write to the seller and say, "I am a Negro," because it was 1961 in the middle of civil rights. And the seller said to him, "I don't care what color you are, if you can afford it, it's yours." So he and Thelma got in the car, drove to Maine, and bought this piece of property that reminded him of his roots back in Georgia. The property had a little brook on it. He used to fish. He put in a huge garden. Every year he would come up in May, and he would plant his garden. One year I gave him a peach tree for his birthday, and this is years ago. He actually, you know, was probably one of the first people who could grow peaches in the state of Maine. But he was just a wonderful, wonderful, kind, gentle human being and very generous with all of his knowledge, which was vast.
Peggy, with these two shows going on, both at the Portland Museum of Art now and Cove Street Arts, what do you hope that people who are not previously familiar with David Driskell, maybe younger people or people who have moved here from somewhere else, learn about him and take away from that?
I hope they learn just how important he was, especially in furthering black artists in this country. Because again, that show that you just spoke of at the LA County Museum in 1976 was huge. He was on Nightline, I believe, interviewed by, I think it was Ted Koppel. And I believe the opening question was something like, "Why did you decide to do this show?" And David's answer was, he looked at him, he said, "Specifically for that reason. You just asked that question. People need to know about black artists." And you've already talked about his collection, which was vast and all over his house. He shared it with everybody. He was a very generous man and really believed in supporting black artists, as he did with Indigo Arts Alliance right here in Portland. He was a big supporter and still is. There's a scholarship in his name there, as well as at the Heine Museum.
Well, Peggy, thank you so much for taking the time to call in. Peggy Golden, longtime owner of Green Hut Galleries, and a friend of David Driskell's. Thank you so much for calling in today. Jordia, let's talk about that. We haven't talked about that yet, the role that David Driskell played in the formation of the organization where you are, the Indigo Arts Alliance.
Yeah, I'm so grateful to all of the callers that shared their firsthand experience of Driskell and his just contribution to not just the state of Maine, but also nationally. He truly was a star and an icon in the sector. I mean, he has contributed from advising the President Bill Clinton in the White House to acquisition the very first African-American art in the collection. So, I mean, when you think of the contributions, big, small, national, global, local, it's just truly tremendous. And so to have him be our inaugural advisor in the development of Indigo Arts Alliance, as we were truly thinking about how do we conceive a place that centers Black and Brown artists and creatives in a state like Maine, he truly talked us through it. When our co-founders, Daniel and Marcia Minter, brought the idea to Driscoll, he was the first one. They kind of workshopped this ideology and this philosophy of what our mission can be with him. So it really, we have this internal story that goes around that there was, Indigo was an idea on a napkin, and that's how it started in the living room with Driscoll, just speaking about everything of how do we welcome Black and Brown creatives into the state? How do we support those who are already here? And what could it be? And so out of that, we conceived several ideas. The core one was around mentorship. And Driscoll, again, gave so much to anyone that he came in contact with, whether it was through food, sharing his physical space, or his intellectual brilliance. And so we center our program around artists being paired together in studio, so they can build their own networks, they can lean on each other, they can have really thought processes about what they're doing independently and what possibilities that can be created jointly. And out of that, we have been able to serve about 10 artists in a calendar year through our mentorship program. And then right before his passing, we wanted to honor his legacy of his contributions to the state. And so we had a conversation with him of creating a fellowship under his name. So the David C. Driscoll Fellowship at Black Seed Studio. And he was the first artist that contributed financially for us to start that fellowship in his honor. And that awards Maine-based artists or Maine-rooted artists studio time for an extended period to be able to create. We know access to studio is, one, very hard to come by in the state of Portland, and two, can be very costly. And so this fellowship provides an opportunity to eliminate both of those barriers. So it's an application process, and actually applications are currently open. So if you are a Black and Brown creative, please go ahead to visit indigoartsalliance.me, and the application form is open and available for you to apply. And you will be considered or be a part of our 26 and 27 cohort. So
great. Anjali, I want to quickly correct something. I said that back when David Driscoll was young, he set aside $3,000 a year to collect art. That was not true. $3,000 a year was his actual salary. And even at that low salary, he still set aside money to collect art.
That's right. Yeah. And I think it makes it all remarkable. Teachers weren't paid that much when he was still, but especially when he was teaching. So
No, it reminds me of Bruce Brown when he was a teacher at Freeport High School. He set aside money to collect art and built up an extraordinary collection. We are talking about David Driscoll. What do you want to ask? What do you want to say about him? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. or post on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are learning all about David Driscoll, who is not only an artist, but a scholar, a curator, a writer, and a teacher. He was a key figure in documenting the work of other African-American artists. With me for the hour, Jordia Benjamin, who is with the Indigo Arts Alliance, and Anjali Leibowitz with the Portland Museum of Art. Share your comments and questions. Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And we will go to a caller. Cheryl is calling from Surrey. Hi, Cheryl. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm really enjoying the program. We've been admirers of Driscoll's work for a long time, and we lived in Nashville, Tennessee, for a few years, where a historically Black university, Fisk University, had a great little art gallery, the Van Becten Gallery. Driscoll taught there for a few years, and he probably influenced the collection, because they had a great collection of Black artists' work and a collection that was donated by Georgia O'Keeffe of modernists of all colors. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about that and whether his time at Fisk overlapped at all with his time in Maine.
Thank you, Cheryl. Jordi or Anjali, do either of you know the answer to that?
Well, if he bought his house in early 1960s, then probably he was going back and forth between Nashville and Fisk, given the timeline. And that collection from Georgia O'Keeffe, I think, was absolutely influential to him. And he became good friends with her because she never let go, really, of any of the gifts that she gave. She became great friends with many, many curators. And she seeded many collections, museum collections, from Alfred Stieglitz's collection of modernists. So he was really plugged into the full history of 20th century modernism and art. And I think it provided models for him of collecting and thinking about collections as groupings, and doing it at a historically Black college at Fisk, also at Howard, I think was all the more important to him.
Cheryl, thank you so much for your call. Anjali, do we have any sense of how he had so much energy, how he was able to do all these things? It sounds like we're describing a superhuman here.
You know, I've only seen him speak. I never had the pleasure of meeting him personally, but my impression is that there are people who are just super energizer bunnies and that he was one of them. Jordia, can you speak to that a little bit better because you knew him?
I wish I had the recipe of his energy. I have no idea where it came from. I met him very on multiple occasions, but the first time I met him was in 2014. He was the curator of an exhibition at the Smithsonian Museum of African Art, and he was doing a tour. And the way in which he was able to just walk through the room and the depth of knowledge that he provided on each singular artwork. And he also created a very large catalog that came out of that exhibition and was called Conversations. It is thick. And he knows every single artwork that was represented in that catalog. He also wrote the catalog. And it just flows from a fountain. And I just can't describe it outside of that. It's just ongoing. But it's not in the way of like a energizer bunny that is just jumping from one thing to the next thing. It is just this like constant flow of just steady energy. That is also very calming. It grounds you when you're in his presence and you sit and you want to soak in with his knowledge. And it continued when I was at Colby College Museum of Art. He was one of the honorary artists for the college summer luncheon. And again, I mean, that had years had passed from our first meeting to our second meeting. And he's still, you know, we would go on walks around the college. And it was just this, again, this constant, gentle, but very welcoming. He wanted to know more information about yourself. He really made you the star of the show when you were in his presence, when you knew that you were, with the David Driskell. Like, it was one of those life-changing moments, but he really centered whoever he was with at that time to be in the spotlight and to learn more. So I think that's what probably led to his renowned and profound network. Mm. Everyone wanted to be next to him.
Yeah, I want to talk about his life's mission of amplifying and promoting Black artists. It seems to me that some Black artists don't want to be labeled that way. They'd be preferred to be called an artist, and that's completely understandable. While others are fine with a different kind of label, and I'm wondering how David Driskell felt about that, and Jordia, how do you feel about that?
I think we have to think about the period of time in which Driskell was creating, you know, where saying that you were a Black creative was not mainstream. And so owning that and to be identified as a Black artist was extremely important. And so, you know, we have evolved
Artists have different interpretations of the ways in which they want to be described. And I think that's also powerful that we have ownership on how we want to be labeled or defined. And I think that's truly what Driscoll was bringing attention to, is how do you define yourself in a market that can be overly saturated, but also absent of Black and Brown creatives? Like, how do you take authority and ownership over your own definition?
Yeah, Anjali, what would you like to join, add to that?
You know what? I 100% agree with what Derigia said. And one of my favorite quotes from him around the time of two centuries of Black art is he says, you know, we don't go around saying white art, but it's important to keep saying Black art until it becomes recognized as American art. And I think that's really what he was after, was that it should be normalized. And it should be part of all the institutions. And you see him doing that in his own career, going back and forth between historically Black colleges and majority white universities. There's this way in which he moves through both worlds and eventually establishes this field. And it's I think exactly what Jordi was talking about before, that kind of calm, steady energy and vision over many decades that comes to fruition.
I'm wondering, I was going to ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Jordia. Is there a particular work of David Driscoll's that has more meaning to you than others, and why?
Oh, why are you doing that to me? Wow.
Question.
Really hard and on the spot too.
Okay, Anjali, you want to go first?
My goodness. I have to go back to one of the works in the exhibition. You know, I really love the frost painting. I'm not a snow person, controversial to say in the state perhaps, but it's so beautiful and abstract. It's such an everyday kind of vision, but he makes it gorgeous and it makes you long for winter in a way that, you know, maybe someone who grew up elsewhere isn't used to. And it really does have this feeling of longing for me, as well as, you know, that beautiful push-pull and play of the staccato brushwork that he uses, which is in such great conversation with someone like Alma Thomas. There's just this way in which it speaks to the heart and not just the mind.
Okay, your turn, Jordia. I gave you some time with
I
Anjali
appreciate the I appreciate it. I'm thinking about a work of art that was in the Colby College Museum of Art collection, and this was one opportunity when Driscoll was in town during the summer visiting, and he was given an actual tour of the museum, and he paused on this actual artwork. And the artwork was surrounded around a very hard period in Driscoll's life. And the painting was in response to the murder of Emmett Till. And he spoke about, you know, how he had this painting in his closet for quite some time. And it took him a while to revisit it. And I think that, you know, what really captured me as he was talking about it, was, you know, his positioning and speaking to movements that were happening, you know, social unjust, and how he was grappling with this history, but also, you know, to him at that time, it was current. And how do you document it? How do you grapple with trauma and Black lives that are being lost in such brutal ways. And so to just understand that he was looking at historical narratives and lens and holding them with such empathy and taking his time with conceiving these stories and putting them out outwardly was very humbling. And just to see the emotions and waves in which he was responding to the work also again spoke to the type of human being that he truly is and was.
Joining us now is Richard Kane, who's a documentary filmmaker who directed the film In Search of the Creative Truth, which is a film about David Driscoll, which will air several times beginning tomorrow night on Maine Public Television. Dick, thanks for calling in. Tell us about the title, In Search of the Creative Truth.
Well, it was something that David had said in one of his interviews, and he really was always searching for the truth, and it was, and his life was all about creativity. So In Search of the Creative Truth seemed to be appropriate. Mm-hmm. He was a brilliant man. He was a regal man. He wasn't your ordinary artist. He was a real educator and a deep thinker. So I was very attracted to him, and I was first introduced to him by his gallerist, Peggy Golden, Green Hut Galleries, and Bruce Brown, who was a great art educator in Maine. So Bruce and I went around to Philadelphia, interviewing some friends of David's, and David himself as well, and several others. So it was a wonderful project to be part of, and to get to know David was really a pleasure, and it was a wonder. He was a terrific fellow, and we're missing him greatly.
Yeah. What struck you about him and his approach to life? I understand there's a quote about diversity that stood out to you as emblematic of what a deep thinker he was.
Well, that's for sure. And it's even most appropriate today when we have the diminishment of all kinds of diversity, DEI programs around the nation. But David was a great proponent of diversity and recognized how important and the value of diversity in America, particularly as it relates to art, because, you know, the art in America really comes from all around the world. And he really felt that, and the quote is, we can all but dazzle the world with our universal view that I think very few people throughout the world can do. So he was really... he really felt the value of diversity in all of that he did, and particularly in his art and the art that he came in contact with, as a teacher as well, because he taught so many artists.
Well, Dick, thanks so much for calling in. That's Richard Kane. He's a documentary filmmaker, and the film that we're talking about is In Search of the Creative Truth. It will air on Maine Public Television tomorrow, February 19th at 9:30 p.m., and also on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You can go to mainepublic.org for more information. Thank you, Dick. You know, we're almost out of time, Jordia, but I was wondering before we go, with so much attention right now to David Driskell with these two exhibits and then the film airing on Maine Public Television, what do you want people to come away with as they look back, as they learn about him, and as they look back on his life?
Yeah, I think that he's a pioneer. He was a champion of the arts, of creating spaces and opportunities and amplification for Black artists, and truly paved the way in which we are able to define and recognize Black art as American art. And he truly had a love for all people, of course, for nature, building community and how do you sustain community, understanding it takes all of us to truly achieve collective freedom and to be completely liberated. And so I just want folks to, especially in this current moment, to really sit with that of how do we continue to build, amplify and strengthen community bonds, and also support artists as well.
Mm. And you have figured out the name of the title of the painting you were talking about before.
Oh, yes. It is called Of Thee I Weep. It was created or finalized in 1968. Mm-hmm. So just do a quick Google to visualize that particular artwork.
Of the I Weep by David Driskell. And Anjali, how long is the show up at the Portland Museum of Art?
Oh, it closes, I believe, next week. I don't have the exact dates on hand, but you don't have much time, so please come to the museum and see it as soon as possible.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for joining us today. Anjali Leibowitz, Curator of Photography at the Portland Museum of Art, and Jordia Benjamin, Executive Director of the Indigo Arts Alliance. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, what to know about alcohol consumption, the latest research, and what it means for your health. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.